are.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For eons, since life first twitched into existence from the primordial soup, the forces of evolution, of nature, and nature alone, sculpted the lines of every living thing, the tiger, the lamb, humankind. For millions of years, the rate of genetic change fluctuated with the rhythm of the planet's own music. Now, says environmental author Bill McKibben, that may be about to change. McKibben writes in his new book, Enough, that the convergence of awesome new technologies has brought the human race to a fateful point of decision. Choose all that 21st century technology offers, and we may literally never be the same. Science, he warns, is dangerously close to changing what it means to be human. Genetic engineering and nanotechnology, he says, are about to break the boundaries and our very understanding of ourselves. Tonight on Point, technology and the reshaping of human nature. One man says, enough. But is it within human nature to walk away from new technology? Can we, will we, embrace all that science now offers and remain human? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Portland, Oregon, is Bill McKibben. He made some big waves with his first book, The End of Nature, back in 1989, paving the way for the debate on global warming, a regular contributor to the New York Times, the New York Review of Books, and The Atlantic. His new book, Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age, is yet again spawning debate. Good evening and welcome, Bill McKibben.
Tom, what a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you, Bill. Bill, I sat with your book, and it brought right away, from the very first pages, to mind an essay, a long essay that Bill Joy had in Wired magazine back in the year 2000, where he described Ray Kurzweil's forthcoming book, The Age of Spiritual Machines, outlining this utopia where he saw humans gaining near immortality by becoming one with robotic technology, as Bill Joy wrote. That gave Bill Joy a long second thought. And of course, this was the head of Sun Microsystems, a super tech guy. A long pause in the year 2000. Here we are in 2003, and you're laying out a thesis at book length saying that we are in danger of losing what's most important about being human, of changing what being human means, what it is. What's got you so concerned right now, Bill McKibben?
Well, we're at an interesting point. I mean, in fact, this is a good month to be talking about it because it's 50 years ago this month that Watson and Crick fired the starting gun in the genetic age, you know.
The double
helix.
The
double helix. And since then, we've done an amazing amount of fascinating work undercovering the basic mechanism of our biology. And we've found all sorts of useful applications in things like treating disease and so on. Work that, though extraordinary, is also recognizable as science and medicine that we're used to. But now we appear to be nearing some kind of real fork in the road. In the last few years, researchers have managed to take the embryos of literally dozens of different species, including primates, and tweak the DNA within those embryos in order to produce particular outcomes. A scientist would call this germline genetic engineering. A layman would call it creation of designer babies.
Germline, meaning not germs, but that it gets right into the DNA in such a way that
the very
DNA is changed and would be transmitted to subsequent generations of that life.
That's right. And so James Watson, who is a big proponent of this kind of work, has said as recently as this month that we should be doing this germline genetic engineering in order to ensure that there are no more stupid people, no more shy people, cold fish, he calls them, no more ugly babies. Those things, or some version of them, appear to be within at least the plausible reach of the science. That is, we've done things very much like that with a wide range of other animals, changing their appearance, changing their emotional makeup, changing their social behavior.
And your big point is then that we're at risk, and I want to come back and look at exactly where you see these lines because they're quite clear the way you've drawn them, that we're at risk of not just another scientific advance as humankind has known these in the past, but of scientific advances that change human beings themselves irrevocably, that we in some sense turn into a different creature.
That's right. I mean, at first blush, it sounds kind of good, you know, smarter kids and handsomer people and things. And yet, it makes most people feel queasy. Part of the work of Enough, this book, was to try to figure out where that queasiness comes from. Some of it is for obvious pragmatic reasons. It doesn't take much power of observation to realize that in our societies, these would be technologies for the rich and not for the poor, that we would be rewriting in our biology the divisions in wealth and power that bedevil our societies. But for me, the discomfort went one level or several levels deeper than that, and it had to do with questions of human meaning. These are such large technologies that they allow, they force us to ask questions that normally we would shrug off as too abstract, too silly, too ephemeral. What does it mean to be a human being? Say that, as many scientists think will be relatively easy to do, we'll be able to find, in fact, we already have found many of the stretches of gene that regulate the production of serotonin or of dopamine and hence control mood. Happiness chemicals. They envision a kind of targeted permanent Prozac.
Now, so which Prozac, would become a new part of human nature, that humans would simply be happier, a happier breed of people.
Or whatever the word would be, happier, mm-hmm. I guess. You know, Prozac is a great gift, but even in its current form, as you know, there's been all sorts of discussion about what exactly it means and how people tell who they are and who the drug is. And now imagine a world where that's permanent, ineradicable, something that was done to you before you were born. You can go on and on and on down the list of traits. One of the things that I came to think is that human identity, human meaning is a more vulnerable construct than we sometimes think, and that it can't survive turning people into products, making us into nothing more than a kind of checklist of traits that someone wants to produce.
You write early in the book, Bill, about running a marathon and feeling your own human limitations and the satisfaction, a very deep one, of pushing those right to the limit and knowing that you've done all you can do with what you've been given. But then you imagine, as I recall, the parents in the not-too-distant future, perhaps, sort of buying different capacities for their children before they're even born, before they're mixed up in a test tube, that they might be able to run twice as fast, twice as far, sort of the same way you'd buy horsepower in a car. And out of that, you come up with this radical notion, it seems to me, because it collides with so much of what we think is also very human, this notion of enough, that yes. That what we are is somehow enough, that we should stick with it, stay with it, not despoil it. But is that idea itself contrary to human nature?
Well, let's back up for a minute, because the marathon example is such an interesting one. I guess I'm thinking of it a lot because I was in Boston last week to run the marathon. And I'm still.
What was your time, Bill?
3:34, Tom. Only an hour and 10 minutes behind the winners.
Yeah, could have been a contender.
What's amazing is that, you know, it doesn't. The meaning of that event has nothing to do with how fast you run it. Your speed is, you know, not the point. The point, you know, of all the people that I was running with from Hopkinton on to Boston, I would say half had something on the back of their singlet or their shirt about a picture of some a friend or relative who was sick or had died, whose memory they were running in. When people crossed the finish line, they were in tears, and not in tears because of the pain of running, but because it was some kind of peak moment in their life.
Testing their own limits for a reason, not just as a machine whipped up in a test tube.
To find out, at some level, who they were.
And as you sort of
and you
suggest,
can't do that. I just can't do. I mean, any more than like the Tour de France rider. Mm-hmm. You know, a few years ago when the Tour de France became this kind of chemical playground, it lost kind of all interest for a while until they got rid of the drugs. Because what were you testing? Who had the better, you know, hypodermic?
And that's your fear that humans, or at least the part that a portion of the humanity that could afford it, would be turned into a kind of all buffed up, high horsepower, super equipped model,
it's hard
but without
to draw
resonance, without
a sort
meaning.
It's hard to draw a sort of clear line between what we'd be turned into and what a robot would be if we took this germline genetic engineering to its logical extreme.
Bill McKibben, you point to a number of specific technologies that have you concerned and where we are in progress in those technologies. And I must say there's a lot of debate about exactly where we are and how close and how real these threats are. But you look first at genetic engineering and you say not at what's somatic, or that is the kind that's used in a medicinal way, but the kind that would perpetually change core genetic character of a human being. You look also at robotics and nanotechnology, the technology of the very small. Describe the forks in the road that you see coming up in each of these.
These are a little further off than where we are with genetic engineering. With genetic engineering, we can already, I think, see where the lines are. Many countries in Europe have decided to ban this germline genetic engineering, I think, wisely.
So does that let's stick with genetic engineering for a moment. Does it put you in President Bush's camp? Are you saying laying across the road when we get to stem cell technology?
No, actually, stem cells are a sort of slightly different point. It's a little technical. But the good news is that if we're careful and wise, we should be able to do work on stem cells without crossing the line into the kind of reproductive cloning that would make this germline engineering much easier.
So where is the line on the genetic front? In your mind.
It's with this intervention in the human embryo to add things or subtract, to enhance that person in a way that nature would not have produced.
So this is the point,
it's
as
not
you described,
about
where babies
repair.
Aren't made in bed anymore. They're made in test tubes, and the DNA is changed before the fetus is ever allowed to grow.
That's right. It's not the repair of problems in existing people. It's not the screening out of genetic disease, even in the lab or in the clinic. Those things strike me as remarkable and pursued carefully are very beneficial. This is the bright line here. When you look at things like nanotechnology, as I say, they're a little further out, and we don't know yet where the lines are. Nanotechnology, in one sense, merely means the next step down in scale, the next order of magnitude smaller from the microscale technology that we've been living with since the 60s.
Mm-hmm. Down to the molecular level.
And that's what's interesting, because when you go down another order of magnitude, you're now perhaps and increasingly able to move around particular atoms. Now, so far, this work has been done, you know, for all sorts of things, both trivial and fascinating.
So what's the challenge? What's the threat to human nature on that front in your mind?
The threat here is that the visionaries of this technology, the people who have helped invent it and who are at its forefront, people like Eric Drexler, foresee a world in the not-distant future when we've gotten good enough at this trick of manipulating matter at its atomic level that we can make anything out of its component atoms. They envision a world where you have what they would call a universal assembler. Imagine, crudely, a machine where you could put atoms, dirt, in at one end, and at the other end take out potatoes or
the
furniture.
The implications for human beings?
Well, here they're slightly different. It's, again, sounds like one of these great, you know, dreams of a magic box. And yet, if you stop to think about it for a little while, it removes most of the need for human beings and the interaction with the world around us. Bill Joy called his piece, the wonderful essay that he wrote, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us.
The molecules would make everything.
This is
they
what
put dinner on the table.
He was getting at. Mm-hmm. Yes, and interact with the world sort of for us.
Bill McKibben, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the future of the human race and technology's reshaping of human nature. With author Bill McKibben, he says in his new book, Enough, question for you, listener. Is it within human nature to walk away from new technology? Do we have a choice? Can we fully embrace 21st century science and remain human? Do Bill McKibben's fears sound urgent to you, or do they sound like science fiction to you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the future of the human race, no less than that, and technology's reshaping of human nature with author Bill McKibben. His new book is Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age, and he has some very major concerns, major fears about where 21st century technology will take us, can take us. You can join the conversation. Could we genetically design ourselves right out of our humanity? Is technology turning from savior to mortal threat? And does Bill McKibben sound like a Luddite to you, like Chicken Little, or does he make you want to throw on the brakes? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bill, in Portland, Oregon, if you'll stand by, if you'll let me, I want to bring a professor into our conversation, Henry Smith at MIT. He's the Keith Lee Professor of Electrical Engineering. He's director of MIT's Nanostructures Laboratory, and I want to hear you two mix it up a little bit on this mortal threat to humanity that nanotechnology suggests. If that's not too gross a characterization of what you're saying, Bill. Good evening, and welcome, Professor Henry Smith.
Hi, good evening.
Thanks for joining us. Henry Smith, you must have heard some of Bill McKibben's argument here. I'm sure it's not the first time, though it may be the most fully formed argument against the field or some end of the field that you're working in or concerns about the field you're working in. Do you, when you go to work every day at MIT, do you imagine that you're working on the downfall of humanity?
No, not at all. I mean, everybody in this field thinks that these assembler ideas are pure science fiction.
The assembler, this is what has Bill McKibben most concerned. And Bill, jump in here if I'm mischaracterizing.
Sure.
But this is where, Professor Smith, that molecules would become little factories that would create things on their own. Is that the essence of it? Help us here.
Well, I mean, I don't want to defend the assembler idea. I mean, this is an idea that you could just move atoms around and assemble anything you want. It's true that all materials and all things are made of atoms, but that doesn't mean that you could create some sort of a machine that would just put atoms together at will. The things just don't work that way. That's not the way chemistry works.
But that's the line that observers like Bill McKibben become concerned, because Bill McKibben, if there were molecular or nanotechnology assemblers, you see them kind of creating all kinds of new things, potentially willy-nilly.
There's a variety of problems identified not by me, but by many of the people working in this field.
Well,
I have no problems at all with what Dr. Smith is doing and that kind of work. It's a little much, though, to say that no one in his field thinks about these things.
What's the gray goo theory, Bill McKibben?
Well, that's... That's this. We talked before about this sort of with genetic engineering. There was a pragmatic problem and a sort of philosophical one. The same here. I've already outlined what seems to me the philosophical problem with the most radical or advanced forms of nanotechnology. The physical problem that some people, beginning with Eric Drexler, have discussed is the possibility that you would start building these assemblers and they would somehow get out of control, and one that, you know, fed off carbon would decide it wanted and could reproduce billions of times a day and things, would decide it wanted nothing better to do than eat every forest on the planet. Personally, I wouldn't lose an immense amount of sleep over that. For me...
Well, nobody in the scientific world does, I can assure you of that.
Well, some people do, because there's a strong ongoing debate over it at places like the Foresight Institute.
Not at research universities, there isn't.
Mm. Well...
So you're more acute concern, Bill?
What I talked about before. As I said, I think that with nanotechnology, these questions are far enough off that we don't know yet where the lines are and what the possibilities for sure are. But the idea that – I mean, remember the enormous gain in power, technological power we got when we went to micro-scale technologies. Mm-hmm. It was unsettling, but we more or less coped with it. as it speeded up societies and allowed us to do some things, good things, and some bad things. And we're talking about an enormous increase in power again as we go another order of magnitude down. We don't know yet what exactly that means, and I think it's much too early to start trying to draw lines. We're closer in this case to where Watson and Crick were 50 years ago than to where they are now. But there are plenty of people, and the documentation is in the book, working in this field who are spending money and setting up labs and working hard to try to produce precisely the kind of devices and technology that I've described. We have gotten to the point where, at least in isolated cases, we're able to manipulate individual atoms.
Henry Smith, come in here, because we want to get your scientist view. Bill McKibben writes in Enough that nanotechnology in the most advanced forms may simply be too strong to mesh with the human condition as we have known it. They threaten, indeed, they promise to destroy the meaning of our lives. How does that sound to your scientific ear?
Well, it's hard to react. I mean, nobody that I know of takes that seriously. I mean, there's a lot of work going on in nanotechnology. We're trying to develop techniques for making structures smaller. We're working both from what we call top-down and from bottom-up. We're working with molecules and studying a sort of self-organization of molecules. We're working on things, what we call templated self-assembly, trying to make a bridge between what we can do with top-down fabrication technologies, the same technology that were developed for microelectronics, and trying to interact with the molecules. But there's just no serious effort whatsoever that I'm aware of, and any of my colleagues are aware of, to do anything remotely resembling the assembler. It just is not in the scientific priority.
And
there may be people that talk about it, but I mean, if somebody asks me about that, I say that's pure science fiction.
Henry Smith, I want to be sure that our listeners, and I'm still not sure I get it, so I'm going to ask again, understand what the assembler concept is, as unattainable as it may be, why people find it bothersome. What is it again, Henry Smith?
Well, I don't want to defend it, but there's talk about
coming out of the
Foresight Institute. Maybe Bill should talk about what the assembler is, because that's not what anybody in nanotechnology actually does. But as I understand it, the idea is to pick up atoms and put them where you want them. But this is unrealistic. The atoms that are important are the ones that bond strongly, perform strong chemical bonds. Mm-hmm. You can't move those things around willy-nilly. I mean, there's marvelous technologies that have been developed through evolution that go on within a cell. So-called enzymes do to enable chemical reactions to go that otherwise would not want to go, would not want to proceed. But, you know, this idea of just being able to pick up atoms and move them around and assemble things is totally naive, unrealistic. I don't know of anybody who takes it seriously.
So do you see nanotechnology, then, as someone who works in it, as an extension of the kind of science that we have known that will bring the kind of advantages that technology and science have brought to humans for a long, long time? Is this just a more sophisticated extension of the kind of advantage that we've seen in the past? Or do you see nanotechnology as crossing some real divide, taking us into a more radical reconfiguration of the world and human interaction with it?
Well, I don't see it that way, and I don't know anybody who does. It's a normal extension of scientific investigations in the fields of chemistry, physics, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering. We are, you know, just pushing the boundaries in a what we call it, a normal progression.
And what about the whole idea, Professor Smith, of, and again, Bill, I don't want to mischaracterize here, but the idea of enough, that at some point science may or possibly is taking us to boundaries, that if we cross them, we lose some fundamental aspect of what it means to be human. You sit at MIT and work every day.
Sure.
I'm sure you hear big dreams there. Do you see that as a real threat? Is it something that concerns you as a scientist?
Well, yeah, there may be problems in the field of bioengineering and fooling around with the DNA in cells and cloning. There may be issues of there, but that's outside of my field. As a human being, I sometimes worry about such things, but I'm certainly not worried about anything that's going on in the field of nanotechnology that would endanger the human race. That's or make us less human. It just nothing comes up along that line.
Got it. There's the report from the nanotechnology front. Professor Henry Smith, thank you so much for joining us for a
few
minutes tonight.
Thank you.
Professor Henry Smith is director of MIT's Nanostructures Laboratory. Alex is calling from Cambridge. Hi, Alex. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for this very important and timely debate. It's a shame the professor's not here anymore, but I just wanted to say that there are people like Zyvex Corporation whose stated goal in the nanotech field is to develop an assembler. You know, it's not something unheard of, and it's not an unrealistic proposition that people ought to be worried about these kind of things. The point I really wanted to make was that it's crucial when we're discussing such powerful technologies, such technologies which are bound to affect the majority of people on the planet, not to mention the environment and all that, that we have a much more open and democratic process of decision making about where these technologies are going to go. The debate ought to be much broader than it's happening now. The decisions that are made today are going to affect the way the direction in which the technology goes tomorrow and the day after, and to what ends they will be used. The people that are making decisions now are a very, very narrow group of folks, CEOs and people running military labs.
And Alex, do you share Bill McKibben's concern that these technologies could take us out of human bounds?
Absolutely. The people who are talking about these things, who are actually debating this on a regular basis, are people like, if you go to extropy.org, transhumanists, artificial intelligence people, life extension people, there's a small but very active community of people making decisions now, which on behalf of everybody else, there's no democracy to the process, it's no transparency, and I'm really worried. I'm not so much worried about the gray goo phenomenon. I'm worried about the people the humans who are making these decisions now.
Alex,
yeah,
good point,
too.
And thank you for the call, Bill.
That's a very, what Alex says is smart. For me, one of the reasons that I started taking all this stuff more seriously was because when I wrote The End of Nature in 1989, mm-hmm. it was mostly about climate change. But since it was about the relationship of human beings to the natural world, I wrote a few pages about the then nascent science of agricultural bioengineering, which at the time was some lab experiments and a half an acre of strawberries in California that had a flounder gene in them to keep them from freezing and frost.
In 1989.
It seemed like a long ways off, and the Professor Smiths of the world were saying, not to worry, this is lab work, we're a long ways away. By 1993, half the corn and soybean fields in this country were planted with genetically modified corn and soy. It happened enormously fast, and whether or not that was a good idea is probably beyond the scope of this conversation, but the important point is just what Alex said. Nobody came and asked any of us. There was no discussion. There was no vote. There was no anything. This needs to become in the near future, especially the genetic parts of this question need to become a real part of vigorous democratic discussion. That's going on in a few other parts of the world, and in those places, people's instinctive queasiness is translating into real political organization and analysis and action.
Adam is calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to have to come down on the other side of this. I find, with all due respect, Mr. Kibben, I find your doomsaying to be almost ludicrous. I mean, we've been bandying about the term human or humanity. Mm-hmm. We're going to lose our humanity. I haven't heard you define it yet. My feeling would be if you don't want to be genetically engineered or if you don't want your children to be, then don't do it. If technology were available right now where I could ensure that my next child would be free of disease or have stronger bones or a greater ability to process data, I think I'd be on that, provided it had been previously demonstrated that there were no long-term consequences.
So you're ready to trade up, Adam. You're ready to get on the genetic engineering bandwagon if it offered
sure.
those kinds of advantages.
Here's one way. here's a kind of logical conundrum for you.
Mm.
Let's say that you go and engineer your next child, your first child. Mm-hmm. You go to the lab and you sit down with your wife and you check off the list of things that you want. You wanted more, better memory, her processor to work better. Okay. 5 years later, it's time for your second child, and you go back to the lab. Well, you know, we all know that technology advances pretty quickly. Now you can get the processor, as you put it, on your next child to go twice as fast as that. What's your first child now? Sort of Windows 95? The project of turning human beings into products is one that we need to be incredibly careful about. And one needs first to posit some real reason for doing it. If it's genetically linked diseases that one is worried about, then you don't need to take this step. There are other things that we're already doing, a pre-implementation genetic diagnosis, that sort of thing, that will accomplish that without stepping over this kind of boundary.
So you're well, Adam, what do you think there? Do you see this as turning humans into products? Or
I don't even understand what that means.
Well, I guess where you can sort of take a menu and design the child that you want. And what about when one becomes outdated, the Windows 95?
Exactly what you're doing, although much less specifically whenever you pick who you're going to marry. I don't buy it at all. I mean, if we're talking about commodification, I think that is a genuine and real concern because, of course, and I just want to say up front, this is going to happen. I think you've got your head in the sand if you think this is not going to happen. And the question is, when it does happen, is it only going to be for the very, very rich? And are we therefore going to have not only a class stratification, but a genetic stratification? I mean, that, to me, that's something that
It's clearly only going to be for the very rich, and even the, or at least the rich, and even the proponents of this technology say so. I mean, the most interesting essay in this regard has been written by the Princeton geneticist Lee Silver, who thinks this technology is coming and not such a bad thing, but says quite clearly that it will divide the world into what he calls the gen rich and the naturals, and he predicts that for the foreseeable future they will have genetically diverged enough to not be able to interbreed. I mean, we live in a world that can't manage to find, 50 cents an African to buy bed nets to prevent malaria. The thought that we're going to build genetic engineering clinics across that continent is, to use your word, ludicrous.
You write about Lee Silver. You quote him talking about humans, the gen rich, the genetically enhanced being, as different from humans as humans are from the primitive worms. This is some point down the road.
Yeah.
As humans are from primitive worms with tiny brains that first crawled along the Earth's surface. That doesn't sound like too great a bargain for the ones left behind, but Bill McKibben says it may not be so great for the ones out there either. And yet, here we are. Adam says, bring it on. I'm ready for it. It's going to happen. And right there is the crux of the issue. We're talking about the future of the human race tonight and technology's reshaping of human nature. You can join the conversation. Is it within human nature to walk away from new technology? Do we have a choice? Can we fully embrace 21st century science and remain human? We're at 1-800-423-8255 with Bill McKibben. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Liar.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about nothing less this hour than the future of the human race and technology's reshaping of human nature with author Bill McKibben. He wrote The End of Nature in 1989. He wrote The Age of Missing Information. His new book is entitled Enough: Staying Human in an Engineered Age. And he's afraid that's not going to be easy. What do you think? Do Bill McKibben's fears sound urgent to you or like science fiction to you? Should certain paths of technological development be outlawed? Is that ultimately possible? And I guess fundamentally, does life need technological improvement? Or is the life we have, to use Bill McKibben's word, enough? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Charlie's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
I'd first like to just observe that there seems to be sort of an amusing but perverse symbiosis between people like Bill McKibben and maybe Leon Cass and Francis Fukuyama, who are afraid of these technologies, and then they're sort of overly enthusiastic supporters of these technologies, like your Gregory Stocks and your Lee Silvers.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
all of them, I think, are completely wrong. I mean, so on the one hand, you have people, Jim Watson being another one, saying, you know, tomorrow, the next day, we're going to be able to add intelligence to our babies, make them smarter, make them less neurotic. And on the other hand, that, you know, in turn inflames the people like McKibben and Leon Cass, who can turn around and sell their books saying, we got to stop this. And
so you see all these as the strongest proponents and opponents, but you're saying they're at the edges? They're wrong, Charlie?
Yes. Oh, yeah, quite. I mean, I'm a biologist. I'm a mm-hmm. geneticist. And,
okay.
and I can say, and I'd like Bill to point out a single advance that we've made in the last 5 years that would allow us, for instance, to engineer the intelligence of a human being. We've made a lot of advances in it when it comes to, say, making cows produce more milk, or as he mentioned before, making tomatoes that can be frozen.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the subtle things that people most want to change, like neuroses or intelligence, there has not been an identified gene for intelligence. There was one, but it was retracted. There have been many potential genes for schizophrenia proposed. They've all been retracted. Ditto the gene for homosexuality. Again and again, these genes slip out of our fingers, and even if we did catch one, it would be almost impossible, I mean almost literally impossible, to change that in the germline of a human infant.
Charlie, stick with us. Bill McKibben, here's our caller. Charlie says,
yes.
Settle down. This is not happening.
Well, so far it hasn't proven impossible in one animal after another. I mean, we've managed to make germline alterations of many different kinds, and they have affected things like intelligence and social interaction. And
in other species.
It's correct.
Charlie?
How would you test that in humans? I mean, if you're a parent, are you going to go and say, let's put in this transgene into my infant? We don't know what the side effects
are. You're saying it's going to be difficult to bring it to bear in humans because there'll be an ethical problem testing it. That's
impossible. That's the ethical problem. The genetic problem is more than I think I can get into in a program like this, but I think you must be aware that the difference between changing a single nucleotide, which is, for instance, the single nucleotide that predisposes people to Alzheimer's, changing that one nucleotide versus going in and putting in 100 entire new genes, which is the sort of thing that you do when you're making a transgenic tomato, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
It's like trying to do plastic surgery with nitroglycerin.
So, Charlie, are you saying that now and forever you're not worried about, in Bill McKibben's words, humans engineering ourselves out of existence?
I'm not. No, I would say I really am not. And there's a very funny, and I can't remember the quote, but the most recent Atlantic by Colleen Murphy, a really funny little article about why she is skeptical about it. And I can't remember the exact quote, but basically, the technology will almost certainly never come about. Certainly not in my lifetime, and I'm not an old man. The actual desire to do it, I think, isn't as present as McKibben would suggest.
You're saying the technology could come about one day, but not in your lifetime. Is that what I understand?
Well, I mean, I would say not even in my grandchildren's lifetime.
And then even if it does, you don't think humans would pick it up?
That is a debatable question.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the idea that this is something that we need to pass laws about right now is completely ludicrous.
Well,
Charlie,
why not pass the law about, in fact, why not, if it's so impossible as Charlie suggests,
mm-hmm.
Then there'd really be no problem, would there, in adopting the same kind of regulations on germline genetic engineering that other countries around the globe have done. The idea that things are impossible or are way, way out in the future and will never happen or are for our grandchildren, I mean, that's a possibility, but Charlie is in a minority among biologists when he takes that position. It's sort of like the same debate that we were having 15 years ago when I wrote the first book about global warming, and people were saying, well, that, you know, what is a long ways away, blah, blah, blah. Look, one is very hopeful that there will prove to be some physical barrier that prevents any of these things from happening, that somehow keeps them from happening in humans the way they've been done in other species. But the question, the idea that there's no need to worry because people won't desire it, seems to me to get closer to the heart of this question about whether or not we can ever say enough to these sort of things. On the one hand, there's some deep part of our human nature that desires these sort of things very much. I mean, God, we live in a society where people are now, injecting botulism toxin into their faces in order to remove wrinkles. You know, the idea that we'd be, unwilling to countenance this sort of thing is wrong. On the other hand, there is another part of our nature that I think we may need to now bring to the fore. If you really said, what is it that makes human beings different from other animals? The answer wouldn't be so much, I don't think, our tool-making ability or our ability at languages or our opposable thumb or whatever. Mm. It would be that we're the creature that can decide not to do something that we're capable of doing.
But, Bill, that's such an interesting point. I mean, because it raises the issue, when you paint it in such enormous terms, of what's human and how we could become inhuman or something post-human. But isn't the very kind of push forward that at some extreme you fear here, isn't that also part of what it means to be human? Perhaps even,
absolutely.
Perhaps even this kind of transgressive move beyond what we now conceive of as human into something else. Is it not possible that in itself is part of what it means to be human, to mutate, to change, perpetually?
These are the two fascinating parts of human nature. And you can hear them even in the voices of the people who have called today. You know, on the one hand, the sort of striving, restless, ever onward, pushing forward.
Bring it on.
Bring it on. And on the other hand, by now, having gone through the 20th century, the kind of more tempered idea that there are times and places when restraint is what's called for. Look, this is a threshold issue. We've had two other of these threshold issues in our lifetime. One came with the invention of nuclear weapons and the understanding that we could obliterate everything in an instant. That's caused us to have to reevaluate what it means to be, how we conduct international relations, what war means. We haven't obviously gotten there yet, but the fact that, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the last two bombs we dropped at least indicate that we're making efforts. The next of these threshold issues was the environmental moment, particularly the understanding that one species, our own, was managing to heat the planet at an enormous rate and thereby change everything on its surface. We're beginning the process, not so much in this country, but in the rest of the world, of trying to put on the brakes about that. And in fact, there are other sort of at least tentative signs that as we begin to grapple with these issues, restraint can kick in.
Do you have people turning to you, Bill McKibben, and saying, Bill, you are the 21st century Luddite. You're the heir to those who would have resisted, who loved this sort of pastoral 17th century life and didn't want to go into the industrial age, but humans move forward. Yeah. There's no way around it. What's your answer to that?
Here's the question. Is the model that you... I mean, in the first place, no one that I know wants to go back to the 17th century or anything else.
Some of the music was nice, there wasn't much smog.
Do we imagine a sort of endless linear progression with ever more power and ever more technology? Mm-hmm. Or do we imagine that at some point we get to the point where we decide enough is enough? And that's an interesting question. There are places where more is always better, and that's a deeply American idea. Bring it on, more is better. There are cases where more isn't better. You know, if you go out at dinner tonight and have a bottle of beer, that'll be a nice thing. And if you go out at dinner tonight and have 15 bottles of beer, it'll be somewhat less pleasant. Thresholds, maturity, restraint, these are things that we understand intuitively as individuals make sense. The question is, Do they make sense, and are they possible societally as civilizations? I don't know the answer to that, but in the book I try to speculate about, suggest how we might finally, with the kind of cold slap across the face provided by the threat of these technologies, try to find out.
Enough. Yeah, but let me get another call in because our time is running down. Leslie is calling. Hi, Leslie. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
I think that within this debate, it's important to make the distinction between those effects that are going to happen to humans, those direct effects of the human organism, and those effects which are going to happen to humanity and the sort of like the way humans interact with their world, the way they perceive their world, the way they live their lives.
And what's the point, the distinction you're drawing there, Leslie?
The distinction is that with when you're looking at just those effects that are happening to humans, like genetic engineering and those things, then that's where people become very nervous and they think about all these worst-case scenarios. When you really look at the effects that are going to happen when you introduce a new technology, like the telephone, for example, you know, you're going to start living your life in a totally different way.
But don't most of these significant technologies that Bill McKibben's talking about have potential for impact on both sides, on the human organism and on human social interaction?
They do have effects on both sides, and the potential for effects on both sides. But I think that a lot of times people focus on those effects that are going to be directly on humans, on the physical body itself.
Got it. Let me throw that to Bill McKibben. Bill.
I think Leslie makes a lot of sense, and here's a way to think about it. I had not read much science fiction for a long time until I started to work on this book. And then I went and read some. In my mind, it was still Robert Heinlein, happy rocket into the future. You know, that's not like it at all. I mean, it is the most dystopian and dark aisle in the whole bookshelf, and movies like The Matrix and Gattaca are representative of the genre. Here's why that's important, I think. These are the only people who have tried to answer the question, what happens when you take a real human being and a real human society, the ones that they're imagining as characters, as writers do, and juxtapose them with technologies that are this powerful, not a little step up like the telephone, but an unbelievable step up like turning your child into a checklist of things that, that you've decided you want. And the dystopian, dark results that those writers produce come from the fact that you can't successfully imagine technologies of that scale and power successfully coexisting with the human scale. If the human scale matters to us, then we need to start thinking. Not, I mean, legislating and things are second-order priorities. Thinking, understanding, trying to figure out where it is that we're going if we don't do anything, if we just let business as usual take its course, or where we might be able to go if we summoned our better angels.
And to say, Bill McKibben would have it anyway, to say enough, or as the last line of the book, to call the world enough is not to call it perfect or fair or complete or easy, but enough, just enough, and us in it. Bill McKibben, you're a nervy guy calling for enough. It doesn't come naturally to a lot of lips, but it makes us think when it comes from yours. We thank you for joining us and sharing
the
whole notion with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
Bill McKibben's new book is Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age. Bill, thanks for being with us. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on Forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help tonight from Chris O'Connor. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBU.